and no one wanted to invest in anything we wanted to invest in. And so the classic way that people measure the value of a fund is if someone else invests in your deal. And no one was investing in our deals. So deep tech wasn't a word 10 years ago. Like Bitcoin was the first deep tech that we focused on, and then we evolved to, we added sort of virtual reality, and then we started to add aerospace. And it was really just about finding great people, and those people happened to be building these in these categories of technology. Like, my media is my email. My email is like, hey, energy is the biggest problem we're going to face in our lifetime. I'm going to solve it. And it's like, oh, okay, that sounds great. Like, you should, like, that would be great if you could solve energy. That feels like it would impact the world. Yeah, unbridled, epic optimism energizes people. And that's my job. My job is to be a battery pack. Brian Armstrong from Coinbase, he did something brilliant. Whenever he fundraised, and he made sure that he had roughly 3 years of money, which enabled him to not time the market with when the wind would pick up, but allowed him enough leeway to sort of endure. That is probably the best question that all founders need to figure out.
Thank you so much to Dula for being the early record of the podcast. For entrepreneurs and founders just starting out, forming a US LLC, a bank account, managing taxes, compliance can be a daunting task. If you're a non-US resident or a first-time founder who lacks the experience, knowledge to navigate the complex legal and financial landscape, it will be impossible for you to do all this. Dula is an automation platform that simplifies the process of forming a US LLC, setting up a US bank account, and handling taxes, compliance for startups and businesses all over the world. Dula's mission is to democratize access to the US market and empower entrepreneurs to focus on building their businesses without getting bogged down by bureaucracy. If you're building a company, there's no better option out there than Dula.com. Hey Adam, how are you? You're doing well?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Advik, for having me on the podcast. I'm glad we can make it work.
Before we get into anything else, I just start with who is Adam? Who are you?
Who am I? How I'll answer that is I'll answer it in two quick ways, if that's okay. First way is obvious. Adam Draper, founder and managing director of Boost VC. We're a pre-seed fund for deep tech startups. We've been doing this about 11 years. We like to invest in the first $500,000 into startups. On the other side, when I sold, I always like to answer a question that's sort of what are three decisions who made me who I am? First decision was in middle school, I was choosing to go to high school. I ended up using the adventure, which was going to boarding school. I went to prep school across the country. I grew up in California. Around here, I'm in Menlo Park right now, in California, and then I ended up going to boarding school across the country in around Boston and over in Massachusetts. And it was just a part of adventure. I was just thinking, hey, I've been going to school with the same kids for a long time. Why don't I see what else is out there? The second thing was junior year of high school. I just walked out of a practice SAT exam. And I realized I was very stressed about this concept of college, but I didn't know what college was because I'd never been to college. And I realized all my friends were stressed about this thing called college and no one knew what college was. And so I went home that break and I said to my parents, I said, I'm not ready for college. And they took it really well. They ended up coming to a conclusion after thinking about it. They came down the next day and they said, I was on the break. So I was at home and they said, well, you have to do something. And so I ended up choosing to play tennis in Australia for about 8 months. So I trained for tennis in Australia. And then the last thing that makes me essentially who I am, I'm going to do two quick ones, which is we have a deal in my family to not drink, smoke, do drugs until you're 21 and you get either $10,000 or a trip around the world. And really, if you think about what that thing is, it's really about identifying where peer pressure is present and being willing to go against the grain. And I accomplished it. I was the first in my family to accomplish it. It was it's a big deal. I think in venture capital, actually identifying where peer pressure is very valuable. And then the other thing that makes me who I am is I have been collecting and reading comic books for my entire life. I'm also an author of a book called Breakfast with Pops. So that'll be my other thing. Breakfast with Pops, it's a venture guide. It's a guide to venture capital that I wrote because I have breakfast with my grandfather every 2 weeks. And he's a venture capitalist. And we talk about venture capital over, you know, eggs and bacon.
It's an epic book. I read in the past, I'm just going through it in the morning too. It's incredible. I mean, because a lot of venture capital books are things in general, they complexify things a whole lot.
My favorite parts is the everyone overcomplicates this like middle part. Like, people overcomplicate venture capital. Venture capital is like, people always come to me and they're like, how do I become a venture capitalist? And the real answer is like, invest in something. You invest in something by working for it. If you have $1,000, you can invest now. Like, it's not it's open to anyone. If you have $500, you can figure out how to invest in something. You become an investor by investing in an idea at the early stages, but really it's about investing in the people. So people doing something interesting at the early stages. And like that, then you're an investor, you're a VC, you're an angel, you're whatever you want to call it. And I think people overcomplicate what we do. It's simple, not easy, I would say. Like, I feel that I've been enduringly attempting to master the craft of venture capital, and it continues to be a learned experience. So I think I still have another probably like 100 years before I feel like a real master. And then I will, then I'll try something else. In 100 years.
Why do you think people overcomplexify things?
It's driven by a lot of things. The normal reason that people overcomplicate things is they don't understand the essence of it, is one of the reasons. They don't understand the why, like why this actually exists, rather than like this is the thing that people talk about. And sometimes it's to obscure away the reality of the situation, and like sometimes the goal is to overcomplicate it to make it sound more interesting than what it is. Like IRR, MOIC, MOIC, TVPI, like all these numbers are just us trying to articulate if the fund that we are currently managing is doing okay, right? That's the goal. And so I'm telling you generally why it's doing okay. And I think a part of my learnings were really from the fact that early in our career, we were really early investors in the Bitcoin ecosystem, and no one wanted to invest in anything we wanted to invest in. And so the classic way that people measure the value of a fund is if someone else invests in your deal. And no one was investing in our deals. So we were like this overlooked group that we had to be cockroaches and just be there forever and not die. And we had to coach our companies into being cockroaches to not die. And now those companies are thriving. Like, those companies are doing really well because they became resourceful. They became not dependent on venture capital money majority. But we were never able to articulate like we're doing well. And so we never looked great. Was one of the problems.
But do you think in the start, when you did not have the specific metrics, did you try to complexify it in order to sound like you had it all under control, or did you simplify it?
Oh, I was probably in the bucket of people who didn't understand what it was like the thing. I was trying to articulate it. I had people run numbers. I had, I was like, oh, how people say IRR. Why are we getting this number? Like, I think I was one of the people who was more just like, I know that this is how you're supposed to pitch, so I am doing it at the beginning. Now, I mostly just say, well, to be fair, our returns are really good now, so it's way easier to say what our returns are. But like, so that's a big part of it. But one of the issues is venture capital is a long game, And so if I report my returns to you 5 years in, they might look horrible. And 8 years in, they might look like the best fund of all time. And like, you're trying to bridge that gap all the time in venture. Like, you're always trying to bridge this gap of like telling exactly the truth, which is some combination of what things are worth and the reality of what someone would buy them for. Let's say I raise $1,000, and then I invest that $1,000 into 10 different deals. I don't know what those 10 deals are worth until way later. If it one of them sells, if one of them goes public, if one of them gets bought, sold to another company. And so that there's real money that I receive, and then there's real money that I return if something exits, but in the middle, there's a gap of knowledge where it's not real yet. Like, I'm trying to articulate how real it is. And that's what these words are, right? Like, I'm just trying to articulate it. In a unit of measurement becomes a target, it ceases to be a good unit of measurement. So I think that IRR went through that. IRR, and so then people switched to TVPI. And then TVPI wasn't really great because you realize you weren't getting the cash out. And so now everyone's talking about DPI again, which is cash on cash. So it's how much cash you're getting. So like, it goes in waves also, but I just think explaining things simply is always fun.
Does this, the messy middle that you have between real money and real money, does that get harder to show to LPs or just people in general, not even LPs, with a deep tech fund?
So fund three is really hard to show. Specifically fund three, because you're about 5 years in and you don't have any returns. Like, you might have like one small exit. You might have gotten lucky doing something, but like, you have no real, your business model has not been proven out yet. Like, you don't know. And so you're really selling based off the fact that you kind of have, you're better now than you were when you started. And you're like, and there's some things that we believe are awesome. But it's a very much, it's still, do you have the energy to go on for another 7 years, right? Like, we get to say deep tech now. Deep tech wasn't a word 10 years ago. Like, we Bitcoin was the first deep tech that we focused on, and then we evolved, we added sort of virtual reality, and then we started to add aerospace. And it was really just about finding great people, and those people happened to be building these in these categories of technology. We just drove this boat, Navier, from this amazing founder, her name is Sampriti, and she originally was building a edge computing device for nautical like buoys and anything that's on the ocean that needs a computer. And then she eventually realized that the best thing that she could do was build the actual boat. It's the best boat out there. And that was due to a very seismic pivot, like 4 years in, 3 years in. Like, that was a big deal.
Every time I hear you talk, or you know, my mind gets blown by things of the future and the way you look at things. How does that correlate with your love for sci-fi and comics?
Comic books have been just this weird love I've had my whole life. So whenever I was bored, sad, lonely, whatever, like, I had comic books to read. And like, it was the most amazing thing. There's a comic book called Alpha Flight that's like the Canadian version of X-Men. And like, in my heart, I like Alpha Flight better than X-Men, but X-Men's way better, like market-wise, everything-wise, like the characters are better than everything. But Alpha Flight to me is like, I had 1 through 70 of Alpha Flight. So I had the whole series up to 70. And I was like, I loved the storytelling. I loved everything about it. Okay. That's too much about comic books. I don't need to go too deep. I give a presentation on comic books for founders, because I relate the story of Spider-Man to startups. Stan Lee is a founder that happened to be working for a company called Marvel. But how it deals with my, how it overlaps with venture, I think that the one way that it probably is very, it was, it organized my brain in a different way, which was, you have to accept an impossible truth very quickly. So like, I think just like I spent my entire life reading about people with superpowers. Like, and so like when someone says like, I'm going to build a suit that gives me superpowers, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. Like as someone else might say like, oh, that's impossible because of the technology and it's only at this level. And I'm like, I don't know. I read about it like when I was six, you know, or eight. And like, I it's probably possible. Oh, you know, I'm gonna build a hypersonic jet. It's like, yeah, the X-Men jet was hypersonic. That makes sense. Like, that completely makes sense. Like, I could relate basically every deal I've ever done to a superhero, and they are heroes. The greatest about me being like, you know, my dad's a VC, my grandfather's a VC, my great grandfather's a VC, my sister's a VC, my brother's a VC. Like, the one thing that I think has kept us in this game for so long is that we know one super undervalued truth about the market, which is the founder's the hero. And sometimes we get to be a part of the story. And, like, that's exciting. It's also humbling. Like, the founder really is the one, like, hustling. And I think founders being heroes and you equate those two, that was a big part of comic books. And then I think just accepting the impossible is like very easy for me.
Yeah, family is like the X-Men for venture capital.
I'll think about this. I don't have an answer. I'll figure out where we play. I would like to think that we're on the, like, you know, in that department, like the X-Men of, but we might be more like the Alpha Flight of. So Canadian, actually, funny enough, Canadian X-Men is how I got into comic books, which is so funny. But my grandfather's first LP was a Canadian, I think, endowment or Canadian. So I'm very thankful for Canada. Like, straight up, I should be thankful, thanking Canada. So, and we've backed a bunch of companies in Canada that we're happy with. So I'm also thankful for those founders.
Even now that I think about, how do you think does media and consuming, so this sort of media, how did that influence the mind on thinking, basically?
You want to know what's great about it? Most media is negative. The news is negative. Everything's negative. You want to read how bad the world is, pick up a newspaper, right? Like, you read the news, figure out what horrible things some great person is doing. I think comic books are the opposite. It's media that is sort of this optimistic view of the world normally. Like, yes, there are some horror ones and there's different topics, but it's like generally they're building out a positive hero to represent some state of the world. Stan Lee, when he created Iron Man, he realized that everyone hated, the media hated businessmen and they hated war. And so he built a warmongering businessman that had a problem with his heart. And it became, you know, everyone who's listening to this has heard of Iron Man or seen Iron Man, probably. And so I think what's amazing about it is in some ways it's characterizing a problem in society that's wrong.
Talk about Iron Man there and things like these. The more we get into the future every day, I think each passing day, the more things like these are sort of becoming a reality. So once things like Iron Man and the so-called impossible become mainstream, do you think is there something else that will be produced in media that can inspire the next generation?
I hope so. One of my biggest fears is that we are reducing our imagination. We're giving away our imagination for whether it be screen time. Like, we are being told how things work more than we used to have to create how things work. My fear is that the imagination is being capped right now. But I believe that great founders always find a way, and there's going to be a new age of media that will create a character that represents some like far off distant future that we will create. Like, we're on the cusp of really understanding the human condition. And I think we all get caught up, but like life's pretty good. Yeah, I think life's just generally like I hope that I was very lucky. I was born in America. Like I grew up with a dad and mom who took care of me. Like there are a lot of things that like rolled the dice and they ended in my favor. But broadly, I look at the world like you read the news, you will think the world is dying tomorrow, right? Like I would say, and I think a lot of people read the news and think that's fact, not like, but when you talk to people, people are doing cool stuff. Like my media is my email, and my email is like, hey, energy is the biggest problem we're going to face in our lifetime. I'm going to solve it. And it's like, oh, okay, that sounds great. Like you should, like that would be great if you could solve energy. That feels like it would impact the world. Hey, water in Africa is historically like bad quality, and not, they have no, like a lot of people, there's no network of water. That seems like a really great thing. Like we've backed companies that do these things. Like Pow Water does the water in Kenya, and Radiant does nuclear energy. And like people are out there every day trying to solve problems that will impact the world in a beneficial way. And like I get to see that side, which makes me I am optimistic because the world only gets better. Like this is the best timeline to live in.
Is being over optimistic a thing, or is that a bad thing, good thing?
I think it's a great thing. I mean, I people might get annoyed around me, but I think it's a fantastic thing because what you do is you, so fear is the mind killer from Dune. That's a Dune quote. Yeah. I think when you're being pessimistic, you're kind of in the fear mindset where you're like, okay, what's the worst that could happen? And then normally what's weird about the world is the optimistic mindset is actually capped where you can't, when things go well, you can't predict how well it goes. Because if it's right and it's well, it could actually be exponentially well and it goes nuts. Like, I mean, I've been a part of the crypto revolution for 12 years and I don't think anyone was expecting what happened. Some people would claim it that they knew always and like, but like, and they might have. Maybe they had certainty where I always question things, but like, yeah, unbridled epic optimism energizes people. And that's my job. My job is to be a battery pack, to like give people, if money is the only thing that is stopping someone from solving one of the world's biggest problems, like that's my job. My job is to find that person who has the ability to do it and unlock and be like, oh yeah, you should do that. It's the best. I mean, how can I not be optimistic, right? Like it's fantastic.
With your founders room and with the Bitcoin revolution that you have supported, both you and Tim actually, you would have been sort of like the torchbearers for the Bitcoin thing. When you are so keen on or focused on one thing and optimistic about something and everyone around you is pessimistic, how do you deal with that?
Not everyone in the world needs to be a founder. Having a founder mindset is probably good, but like it isn't the only job. There are tons of amazing careers and paths. I just specialize in this very weird one that happens to be the beginning of start, like willing things into existence mode. And so how do you deal with like when you believe something that the rest of the world thinks is sort of stupid or trivial? The hardest part is not if they actually fight it. So if they fight it, I actually like when they fight it. It makes it a little more obvious that like I'm onto something because I believe something that they don't. The worst is when people who you respect dismiss it. So like the people around me, all these VCs who I was like, sort of like, oh, well, this is a VC. This is what they do. This is I was sort of, you know, referencing myself to during crypto, my obsession with Bitcoin, but no one else was obsessed with Bitcoin. They all would be like, oh, is that Bitcoin thing still a thing? That was the question. It was like, is that Bitcoin thing still a thing? And, you know, you get asked that 100,000 times and you start to be like, is it? I don't know. Like, I don't know. What do you think? Like, you start looking for answers. And so I would say the hardest part is not when you have a belief. It's maintaining the belief unyieldingly for like an extended period of time and willing to stick your neck out for it. And like, a lot of people don't like looking stupid. I've never had that problem. I've always looked a little stupid. So it's like, I feel confident when I feel high conviction, I'm willing to stick my neck out. And actually, even if I'm just trying to test the waters, I'm willing to look stupid because in the long run, I know I'll figure it out. Like that's it. I think it's a self-confidence thing more than anything else. Like I know that it might not be this path, but I'll figure it out over time. I think it's important to just like create insane beliefs and like see if the rest of the world, a good way to test whether or not you can maintain is like come up with some insane belief that other people will obviously fight. And like right now saying climate change is not real would probably make a lot of your friends hate you. And like you get to figure out why, but they don't know anything about climate change. And you have to be okay being laughed at. You have to be okay with like when you challenge someone's beliefs and they are insanely knowledgeable about the topic, you learn that there's like, you learn things. You learn pieces of information that are valuable, and like it's great.
When having such beliefs like that, do you fear being wrong?
I mean, no, I've been wrong about a lot in my life, so like I can't say I fear it because I don't think it's a right or wrong situation in the world. Like, it's a. I think school actually teaches you the wrong things, which is they're trying to say there's a right answer. And what I loved about starting a company when I was a senior in college was that there was no right answer. It was only best answer on the day wins. And like, so by having no right answer, all of a sudden I could do whatever as long as I was solving the goal and the problem. And so I don't think of it as a right or wrong. It's more about like figuring out how to solve the problem that's in front of me. If I were to talk about like I think the fear is more around, like if I were to find whatever my fear was, the only reason being wrong would be bad to me is if I couldn't continue to support people. Being useful to people who are trying to change things, like that would be the only thing that would be sad for me. Life is about just solving the problem that's in front of you and keep going. I think you get addicted to it a little bit when you're in charge of your own destiny, and it's and that's the entrepreneur journey, I think.
Do you think there's pattern matching in solving problems too?
Yes, definitely. They all smell the same, but it's never the right. It's never the same, right? Like when someone presents me with a problem, I generally will be solving that problem in similar ways. Or if I come up with an idea and I'm like, I think that this is a big opportunity, I generally have the same process to get to a, this is a good opportunity, this is a bad opportunity. And normally it has to do with talking to a lot of people. Like, it's just, I talk to everyone about it. And then I'm like, this is what I'm doing, whatever. And so there's a similar like smell to the solution of all problems, but new problems need new solutions, right? Like, I always think one of the problems, innovation is about like, there's a saying about new wars are always fought by old generals. Like old generals are always fighting the last war, I think is what it is, where it's like they learned tactics and things, but then technology changed. Like Abraham Lincoln was able to control the troops for the first time ever real time at the ground because of the telegraph. Like there were these changes in technology that allowed like wars to be fought. And so new technologies solve for like new tactics to be used to solve problems. But I still think they all smell the same, and you have to have a self-confidence to solve it. Like you have to be like, hey, I can solve this. And then I think a founder really is just at like, I can solve this for 10 years. Like they're just like, hey, I have to solve this. I have to solve this. I have to solve this. My entire being is wrapped up in solving this one thing. And I believe it is important.
Being in it for 10 years, technology changes, the world changes, the impossible sort of becomes a possible. How should founders keep up with the learning that happens during that time in order to be relevant or keep up with the technology?
The best founders don't care about technology. Okay, they don't care about using AI. They don't care about using crypto. They don't care about, they care that it's the best way to solve their problem. So they care about whatever problem they're trying to solve. And so actually, when you talk to the best founders, let's say it's like the best founder building nuclear fission, they don't know, they're not up to speed on like the latest generative AI thing, because they are so blinders on solving their problem that they don't, that shouldn't be the thing that matters until they need generative AI to solve their problem. And then they'll get up to speed on it. And so it's not like they need to stay up to date on all this cool stuff. My job is more that than theirs. And so founders should really just be, it's being aware of the world around you, but it's being hyper-focused. I love when I talk to a founder and I reference a celebrity or a technology and they're like, oh, what is that? Who is that? Who's that? I don't know what that is. Like that just shows like how incredibly blinders on they are. Other people are in a rush, I think. They're just like, hey, this is the best technology we have on hand. Let's see if we can make someone fly. Let's see if we can go a little faster. And then it's incremental improvements, and then it's seismic improvements. Like those things happen over time.
I mean, not caring about how long it takes and keeping in mind the money that they have. How did that come together?
That is probably the best question that all founders need to figure out. I always reference Brian Armstrong with this, but deep tech is weird. This is my quick answer. Deep tech's tough. You do nuclear fission reactors. Like there's no business there until you have one. And it takes about 8 years to get regulated to be able to do it. Deep tech is about the moat. If you succeed with deep tech, if you're talking about aerospace or, aerospace, space. It's the moat is you have the thing. So at the beginning, the moat is like you get a grant from the government, and then maybe you raise a little venture capital, and then you hire a team. The team becomes the moat up until the point you have the product. When you have the product, the moat becomes like, I have a product, and we have the ability, and we have a team that is able to replicate this product. But that time frame and the upfront cost is different than if it's a software product. Software product, the upfront cost is zero, maybe a couple of like $100 a month or whatever. But defending it is harder because other people can replicate it. And so like that's what you're spending money on. You're spending money on like that long-term defense moat. Team still ends up being the defensibility. Brian Armstrong from Coinbase, he did something brilliant, which was he was close to running out of money at one point, but whenever he fundraised and he made sure that he had roughly 3 years of money, which enabled him to not time the market with when the wind would pick up, but allowed him enough leeway to sort of endure. And so the recipe on each company is different on like, how do you endure and grow? But you just need to balance these concepts that you have. Like whatever the tools, this is what founders are built for this question, which is with the resources on hand, how can I grow and not die? And what do I need to grow fast? And then when you get to a point and you've proven enough trust, people want to invest in human endeavor is always a good investment, but people have a problem betting on uncertainty. And that's where I live my life.
For the lack of a better word, people, the founders have to try to build a moat around the technology that they use so that others can't replicate it. But one thing, a lot of people mention this, but something that comes to my mind, basically, I don't know if it comes to other people's mind. If the founder is really focused on solving the problem, then why is that they want to solve the problem and not, they don't allow the problem to be solved by someone else?
I think that there are different caricatures and different types of people, even in founders. Like, there's a lot of nuance in that, those categorizations. But I think that that's sort of what it is. The best founders are driven not by, they're driven by money because it gets them to continue to be able to solve their problem, not because they're driven by money. It's like, it allows them to continue. It is not the thing that keeps them in it. Like look at, you know, all the people who have defined our worlds, Bezos, Elon Musk, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, all these people, like, they're very wealthy. Like, they could be done. That isn't what keeps them in the game, right? Like, what keeps them in the game is the fact that they can keep winning and keep trying and keep changing things and keep trying. I think it's about what keeps you in the game. And, like, that's what causes you to do it. Like, causes the addiction of, like, you. Yeah. I think it's important to identify what quest you're on. Identifying a quest you're on and then asking people around you to help is a oddly valuable thing. You want to help, you solve that problem. And so you start to surround yourself with people who are trying to support you and help you and enable you. And I think that the founders are driven by the behavior of trying to accomplish more. And I think that they sometimes are rebelling from experience of, like, the system. Sometimes they're just incredibly self-confident that they can be the one who solves the problem. And sometimes they get lucky and they just happen to have the skill set at the right time.
Talk about people want to help, people who have founders who have a very large vision. But is being a mercenary founder, does that refrain from people helping you?
So we went on a phase where we were, we sort of believed that crypto would go through a mercenary founder stage, and they did. Like, we were pretty predictive there. The missionary founders stay in it for longer. And if you believe, like I do, that endurance is the name of the game, then that's what matters. Mercenary founders can work, and they work in quick chunks. And sometimes mercenary founders are just trying to find what they believe in. And sometimes that, like, I believe people can grow and then own it. And, like, they start to really own the process. You need to want to make money. Like, that is a thing in our business. You can't not want to make money. And that sounds silly, but, like, I think that there's a, we've gone through each, like, new technology, and all of them end up having an idealism to them where sometimes they're not willing to try to make money. They're too idealistic. And there are bad business models out there, and, like, they, and sometimes people don't know how to make money, and they're not willing to listen.
Hey, I've been into startups and VCs since, like, I was 11. What do you think is one fact that will blow 11-year-old me mind?
That jetpacks exist. That everything that you do when you're bored and you're 11 is a multi-billion dollar industry.
Yeah.
I think that would blow your mind. I think that, like, fathom that concept. I mean, when I was 11, I was starting to download music on Napster. I was playing Super Smash Brothers on the N64. I was playing tennis, definitely a big industry, but not relevant to tech necessarily. And I was collecting cards and comic books. And if I actually dug in to understand how those things got to me, like, how did I end up receiving this information and playing with this product? I would be leaps ahead of anyone in business school to understand what industries are going to be impacting the next 20 years. Because business school thinking historically, and 11-year-olds are thinking in the future. 11-year-old, like, that's an edge. 11-year-old's an edge. Like, there's so many things where it's like my dad almost is so much, like, they looked at all the social networks and almost did Facebook, and it was because my sister was early user of Facebook. Like, these products you use are indicative of massive markets, and it's important to know that. Like Roblox.
Definitely. I mean, that blew 50 on my mind. And I think this is incredible. Thank you so much for taking the time out for this. I think that's it from my side. Anything you liked?
Thank you so much. No, this was great. This was amazing. If anyone wants to contact me, we invest in early stage startups. So you can email adam@boost.vc. Feel free to. And I do reply to my emails. Yeah, and then buy my book, Breakfast with Pops. That would be my next thing.